As I get started, as some of you are a little worried that we're going to see pictures of cadavers, we're not. I'm not going to talk about cadavers so much. And I think as I was listening to the last talk, I was thinking that part of what I'm trying to do in faith integration in this lab is really talk so much about their experience of what it's like to work with a cadaver. And so perhaps in a sense, I'm trying to show them a little bit of grace and helping them weed through that process of what it's like to work with a cadaver. And so part of what I'm going to do for the talk is really try to give you a sense of what these students feel like as they enter this course. So at Azusa Pacific University, we are a faith-based institution, and we are expected to integrate faith actively into our content of our discipline. And that takes three basic forms. So one is, what are the challenges to faith in our discipline? And then how does our faith make us look at that discipline differently than someone who maybe is not a Christian? And how does that discipline, what we're experiencing in our discipline, help us look at our faith different than someone who might not be in biology? So to start out with, I want you to just think about what a typical student is like. Now, I teach undergraduate anatomy. This is a prerequisite course for our students going into a number of different fields. They want to head toward physical therapy, physician's assistant, applied exercise science, athletic training. But the students who really kind of shaped this project are the students going into nursing. So this is a student, we'll just call her Nancy. She's a first semester freshman, so her first semester on campus. Getting into nursing right now is extremely competitive. We now have high school seniors with a 3.8 GPA and pretty strong SAT scores who can't get into nursing programs because they're just really backed up. So the students, at the point when I started this project, the students would come into APU, they would need a really strong grade in anatomy, chemistry, and algebra their first semester in order to apply to nursing. So they're already under the gun to do well in that course. They're also adjusting to college life. So they've got new eating and sleeping habits, they're away from family, all of those types of things. We tend to kind of downplay that, and so yeah, all students are going through that. But I've had semesters when I first started at APU, my predecessor was still kind of doing things the way he had done it, and we had students, it's 100 degrees outside, they're not eating, they're not sleeping, and the first week and a half, they walk into an anatomy lab, and we open up the cadaver box, and they have to look at that. It's the only time in my career I had somebody pass out at a cadaver table. So they are going through quite a bit. We also have exams every couple weeks. So they've got to hit the ground running to do what they need to do. So one of the questions that someone like Nancy might have is, how am I going to deal with this cadaver? There's the smell, there's the sight. I'm looking at a person. How do I get beyond that to start learning these structures that I need to know for my test? And how do I even act in the lab? I mean, if something funny happens, can I even laugh? Is that appropriate? So one of the ways that we orient students is through a lab safety contract, which most universities have with the lab. And it goes through the general lab safety issues, of how to be safe in the lab, but also has our cadaver-specific policies. And they are things such as how we care for the cadaver, how to act around the cadaver, no photography in the lab, and access only for enrolled students, faculty, or staff associated with the course. But what I find, as students get in there, it's the first day, we read through it, we talk about it, they sign off on it, and they forget about it. And so it's not really giving them the impressions that I want them to have. As a faculty member kind of running an anatomy lab with cadavers, here are some of the things I deal with. Confidentiality and privacy of cadavers. And I'm going to relate that to patient care. It's a little hard to make that connection, so stick with me and we'll get to that in a few minutes. Some of the common problems I've had. Students they're working in the anatomy lab. They see things in the cadaver. It's really, really amazing. It's really a great experience. So they're somewhere else, maybe in the dining hall, maybe in the library. They're talking about what they saw that day. They're talking about material. I've had students come back to me and say, all of a sudden we looked around and everybody around us was staring at us because they were talking about things and they didn't realize that people were overhearing them and those other people weren't ready for what they were saying or maybe wanted to hear that. Inappropriate access is probably my biggest concern. I've had it work both ways. I've had students in the lab who are so excited about what they see, they want to bring their friends in to see it as well. Not appropriate. I've had students on the outside wanting to see a cadaver, wait until the doors are open. We have usually two locked doors between the outside and inside. This was not at APU. This is another institution I taught at. The student waited, ran between those two doors, got inside. I heard a big gasp, heard a student run out. Basically went out and he's sitting in the hallway with his head between his legs, hyperventilating, trying to deal with what he saw. So I try to explain to students that those doors are there to protect the cadavers who donated their bodies and also to protect people on the outside who may not be ready to see that. So what I'm trying to drive to students is that the issues that they're dealing with are very similar to what they're going to deal with as dealing with patient care. when they get to the hospitals within a couple semesters. Privacy and confidentiality and professionalism. So how do we do that? And I would say that how we relate to these issues really depends. Our faith makes a difference in how we relate to these issues. So what I try to do is we're going to use three published case studies that we read through with the students and discuss that I think helps them understand some of these potential problems and things that could develop in anatomy. So here's the first one. The first one is a student's vulgar blog post leads to a lawsuit. These were nursing student at Louisiana State University. She was doing an OBGYN rotation, posted stuff on MySpace. It's kind of creepy when you read the full article. She called the new babies demons from hell and the new creep. Somebody caught on to that. They dismissed her from the nursing program, and she sued the school and said First Amendment rights. Courts agreed with the student and reinstated her because they said she didn't violate patient confidentiality. There's nothing in her statements that you could tie to a specific patient, and so therefore it was okay. Well, at least within the court system. The second case is you make the call, student ousted over Facebook pic. Also nursing students, so this resonates with students like Nancy in my class. Also OBGYN rotation, they had a placenta, basically a specimen, and that was really cool. So they asked if they could take a picture. The instructor said, as long as there's nothing identifying the patient, it should be okay. And they even told the instructor, we're going to put it on Facebook. And she said, oh, you girls. Well, they did. And so they were also dismissed, sued the school, and were reinstated. Same thing. The courts ruled the posting did not violate patient confidentiality or privacy. The third case is the one closest to what I deal with in the anatomy lab. So no free speech rights to diss dissected cadavers. This was a mortician student at University of Minnesota. She actually clipped portions of the cadaver's hair to take out with her. Now that's pretty much a standard no-no. You do not remove anything from those cadavers and remove it from the lab. She also made a lot of comments on Facebook about the dissecting practice. And apparently she'd broken up with a boyfriend or had some personal issues. So she talked about using dissecting tools to stab someone in the throat. Police were called in, determined there was no threat. So what the university did was they didn't dismiss her, but they failed her from the course. They made her take an ethics course, and they made her undergo psychiatric evaluation. She also sued, but this time that the courts upheld the school and said, yes, that she did violate the code of conduct that she signed at the beginning of the semester. They also said that her comments were disturbing enough that it did warrant some additional action. So after we read through those in class, I let the students discuss. So did the confidentiality or privacy of the patients or cadavers, was that compromised in these situations? So they're pretty animated. And then I talk about, even if the court said that there wasn't a violation of privacy or confidentiality, did these students act in an ethical or professional manner? And I just define ethics as to do the right thing. Kind of say, if you were a patient in the hospital, would you want somebody taking pictures of one of your specimens and putting it on Facebook? And then we talk a little bit about what does the Bible speak? And in the kind of a written journal reflection, I asked them to just look at some verses on how we care for one's neighbor. And I realized, and I asked them, are the cadavers our neighbors in that sense? And I realize I'm really getting into some theological grounds. We've had a lot of discussions on Imago Dei, and I realized that there's a great questions of what Imago Dei means for these students to walk in and see a cadaver. I'm not prepared to go into that today, and I'm not prepared to do that at this point in the semester with the students. I'm really trying to just get at, do we have a responsibility to care for the privacy and confidentiality of that cadaver as someone who was a living person? And then we talk about where and with whom can they discuss events that take place in the lab. So I want to make sure it's clear to students. We have students who've had family members hurt in car accidents, dying of cancer with neurological disorders. So I want them to know if there is something that they either see. We have pathology in the cadavers that can be pretty amazing. If you see something that bothers you or disturbs you, I want you to know where to go with that that's appropriate. So you're not on Facebook or MySpace. So we talk about lab assistants and instructors and those types of things. Then the last is, what are the character traits that could guide those individuals in those case studies to make better decisions? And so the themes for this talk is, what I'm trying to develop is the students need to develop a sense of being self-reflective in their behavior and their profession. And even though we're in anatomy, we're building up to them working in the clinics with patients. I'm going to use virtue ethics as a way to develop character traits that can guide good decisions and actions. So this is globally this is a part of what's called social learning. Social learning is basically you're learning in a context of other people. So both their peers in the classroom, people out in the public, other people, and so those things influence how you learn and how you behave. It's a prominent theme in medical training. This is a large field. I'm just getting into it. So there are examples in medicine. Now they do problem-based learning. There's also communities of practice. So social learning, which is really what this is embedding on, is very prominent. It's also a type of self-regulated learning. So for example, they've done studies with third-year medical students. They need to know something. What motivates them to go ask a superior, I need help with this patient? Or what motivates them to not say something and maybe put their patient at risk? So it's not just learning more about the kidney, it's interacting in a way that they get the information that they need. All right, so what I'm going to use is virtue ethics. And why virtue ethics? So a virtue is a trait of character or intellect that is in some way praiseworthy, admirable, or desirable. It's a stable or effective disposition. For the Greeks or Romans, virtue was really a way to develop something called eudaimonia, which is like a flourishing, fulfilled life. And this was really an achievement, something that they earned. I chose the cardinal virtues, which we'll talk about in a minute and define those. The reason I chose the cardinal virtues, and I'll talk about that, it kind of flows through the way the semester goes when I teach. We had a semester in the fall of 2009. We just moved into a new science building, had a huge influx of students. After the economic downfall, lots of students trying to get into nursing. And all of a sudden, our program went from competitive to over-competitive, to the point where I have never seen so many grades in the 20th and 30th percentile, test after test, every couple weeks. Students who just weren't prepared for that kind of rigor that fast. Students just a lot of unhealthy behavior, students self-destructive types of behaviors. So in response to that, I felt like I need to give students some way of dealing with that stress. So here are the cardinal virtues. So this is how we go through it in the course of the semester. Courage or fortitude is the ability to overcome obstacles. So as they begin the semester, they need some courage to figure out how am I going to handle all the stress of these courses I need to take and cadaver lab, just dealing with adjusting to college life. As the semester heats up, they usually are looking for some wisdom, and I encourage them to seek a mentor, somebody who can help them, guide them through this process of becoming nursing students or getting used to college life. Temperance is, I usually approach this more from a balanced perspective. Usually by about November, students are getting sick or they're withdrawing from courses. You may need to look at your whole life and kind of see where that balance needs to go. And then the last part is justice. And another way of looking at justice is, are people's needs being met? So I try to keep them focused on not just on themselves, which is it can happen in academics. You can get very self-focused. How are people around you? Are you meeting the needs of your family and your friends, not just yourself? So what we do is we journal through the virtues. There's a theme for each month. They journal two or three times a month. Each journal entry is one paragraph. It has to include some type of activity they did related to that virtue. So they have to say something that they did to develop that virtue, a Bible verse related to that, and then how that verse develops virtue. So I wanted to talk for a minute because there's some conflict when you look at virtue within religious categories. There's conflict over virtue in the Bible. And one of the commentaries I read so people go to the Bible for morals and for moral characters, and that's not really completely why the Bible's there. It's this meta-narrative of God's communication to us. So how does virtue fit in with a Christian faith? For Christians, virtue comes from God's character. The Greeks and Romans sought to develop virtue to become a better person. For Christians, virtue is really a byproduct of our walk with Christ, of our ability to become closer to God and to emanate his character more fully. To really briefly talk about Genesis 1:27, again, we are made in God's image, and that means that we've kind of shared part of his character, but we are also thirsty to grow more, to grow closer to God, and to learn more about his character. After the fall, sin damaged that relationship, and now becoming closer to God's spirit is more difficult, and we really can't do it on our own. So wisdom, then, one of those virtues that I'm looking at, is a part of God's character. And how do we get to know God's character? How do we get to know wisdom? In the Old Testament, you learned wisdom through both the law and the wisdom literature. The law was kind of the black and white of life. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not envy. Wisdom literature, several books of that, are more of the gray areas of life. And they sometimes seem contradictory. You need many advisors to make victory sure, but a man's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand his own way? So wisdom literature is really more about context. In one context, one answer may be correct. That may not be the right choice in a different context. So that's where wisdom comes in. That's part of God's character. But what about courage? A lot of students look at Joshua 1:9. So as the Israelites are about to cross over the Jordan, God says, be strong and courageous. Be very courageous. So one of the commentaries I read said that really that courage is to follow God's law. God also told them, write that law in your heart, meditate on it day and night. And Paul talks about the courage to keep running the race. So as things get difficult and we're challenged, we need courage to keep running that race. Justice comes in when you look at the New Testament, and Christ's death and resurrection bring justice because it resets creation. It allows us to create that or to be in communion with God in a way we couldn't before Christ's death and resurrection. So in a secular sense, when you ask people about justice, they'll often say you get what you deserve. That's what justice is. When we work with students, sometimes you have to really pull at them, well, what does that mean for us as Christians? Do we get what we deserve? And of course we don't. We get much, much better. So for God, justice is harmony. It's allowing us, it's reestablishing that relationship with Him so we can be healed. And then a big part of the New Testament is that how we communicate is not just the law anymore. It's now through the Holy Spirit. So the Holy Spirit guides us in God's character. So we talk about fruits of the Spirit are really just evidence of God's Spirit at work. And moderation or temperance is one of those. So the point is, if you go to the Bible to look for virtue, you can find virtue there. But really, virtue for us is a byproduct of Christ living in us and the Holy Spirit living in us. So one of the points I want to make to students is that reflecting on the presence of virtue can guide us as to God's presence or the Holy Spirit's presence in our life. It's very different than what a Greek or a Roman might have done. A Greek or Roman said, virtue is what I want to be. That's the best. And they strove toward that. That was their goal. Virtue is not our goal. It's a byproduct of the Spirit. But reflection on that can give us insight on where God is in our lives. So that's essentially where we go throughout the semester in anatomy. So to summarize then, I want to pull that back, the students back into how do we apply that virtue to our discipline, to what we've been doing in anatomy. And at this point, by the end of the semester, they've now worked with the cadaver for a while, and they're much more comfortable kind of talking about issues related to cadaver use. So we look at a couple of articles. I don't know how many of you remember. Several years ago, there were two exhibits that went around. They took cadavers, they plastinated them, and then left them in lifelike positions, playing tennis or playing chess. All right, some of the students saw those when they were in high school. Those exhibits have raised a tremendous amount of discussion within the anatomical world, mostly because of the informed consent. One of the group's bodies, the exhibition, was from China. They openly said, we have no informed consent. We just got what we needed. So they just used people without consent. The other one, Body Worlds, has said they had consent, but when people have looked at that, those consent forms, it's not clear that those donors really knew what they were giving their bodies for. So there's been a lot of controversy over that. Even within the United States, there's been controversy. There's no national policy on how to treat cadaver tissue. It's done by the state level or by the medical school that, or the anatomical board. So there has been a lot of talk about this. And so I asked the students, you know, how are these public displays similar to the student who posted the placenta picture on Facebook, and how are they different? Kind of let them talk about their experience of looking at the cadaver and how do they feel about that. And then there are a number of other questions that we look at, but one I wanted to bring up is that identify one cardinal virtue discussed this semester that you used and to discuss how cadavers should be treated. So should we treat cadavers? This one paper looks at it as, should they be treated as property? Same consideration as animals, so as kind of living with souls, but not as rational thought as humans, or should they be given the same consideration as living people? And I want them to just start thinking about, they've looked at virtue for a semester, how can they use that virtue to basically start making decisions about how to treat those cadavers? So in conclusion, this was really a pilot study, and I'm now in the process of getting an IRB proposal to do something formal or to be able to get some data on how they've responded to this. But with teaching medical ethics, it's always difficult in the classroom. It would be great if I could say, we do this, and the students go on, and they now live virtuous lives. They understand virtue. They act it out in their lives. And that's not really possible to say. And that's so I can't really say that. But at the same point, students have responded that they do see virtue differently than they ever did before. They see courage and understand how they act that out in their lives differently than they ever thought. So one of the points is that also in clinics, there's a high stress environment. And so trying to get students to look at virtue and how they're acting within a low-key environment, hopefully that will translate into when they're in a high-stress environment. So the goal of these assignments is really to see and act out virtue in their everyday lives and to reflect on God's presence in all aspects of their lives and their professions. I have a number of references I'd be happy to talk to you about later. And then just as acknowledgments, I just wanted to thank the Ethics Conference at APU, Integritas, which is an undergraduate faith integration discussion, the department and the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences who sent me here, and of course the students. All right, thank you very much.
Questions or comments for Kathleen? You're welcome.
And the students remark with surprise that they're getting a sort of theological course in the midst of an anatomy course.
At APU, they expect it because they get it in all their courses. So all of us are supposed to do some type of faith integration in every course. And we turn our syllabi in, and so they can look at our syllabi to make sure we're doing that. So they're not really surprised.
And they don't feel they've been shortchanged in time, you know, spending this amount on theology rather than...
What I do hear sometimes is just that they're so busy with the anatomy that they feel like they put a lot more time in the faith integration compared to the how the impact is on their grade or compared to other classes. I put in a lot more compared to other classes. So I do sometimes hear that. Yeah.
I think the integration makes a lot of sense, and I have no idea what you're going to be talking about with your cadaver lab. I'm curious if you've tied in the sort of consent and regarding how you handle, you know, dead tissue and that sort of thing to discussions of consent in using, you know, cell lines that become used in laboratories and that sort of issue that's pretty big these days.
And I haven't done that. So right now I've kind of just kept it with cadaver use. But I know we have an upper level course that's a senior sem that students pick some type of ethical type of situation in science, and we've had a number of students look at those types of issues. So that is also a big question, and you're right, that how people use those cell lines in Henrietta Lacks in a lot of those cases. So yeah, that's a good question. Yeah.
I had a student bring in a fresh placenta in a bucket. I wasn't quite sure what to do with it. Didn't really want to use, didn't want to preserve it. Obviously the hospital is in mind letting it, so to speak, walk away. As far as I know, there are not laws on disposal or something like that. But I didn't want to get into that as take back. Thank you.
There are actually laws now. The hospitals are much tighter in the last 20 or 30 years about removing specimens and how those are disposed of. We actually at APU have some collections of things that we got before those laws were in place. So we had to go through a process to basically get a certificate that says, yes, APU got these before these laws were in place. But now to do that, I mean, it's very clear where we get our cadavers. Most of the schools I've been associated with now, you can't take any special preparation out of those cadavers. Everything has to go back with them. So it's much tighter now than it was even a couple decades ago.
It's right next door, practically, that is across the state line from Johnson County to Kansas. And I think it was actually an adjunct instructor who was involved. My personal feeling was that the student should not have been allowed back in the program, and the adjunct turned loose. That's not what happened. As we know. Do you have a feeling?
I think you have to be careful. In that one case with the placenta, the student actually asked the instructor for permission. So in a sense, in that case, if somebody just, like the student who clipped that portion of hair, they could have easily dismissed that student. And I think for them to, I mean, talk about grace, I think for them to even give her a chance to go through psychiatric evaluation and ethics course is a sense of grace to let her fix that. I thought it was also interesting that the first two cases, the schools just said, cut blank, you're out. I mean, we're not even dealing with this. University of Minnesota was actually a little bit braver at saying, okay, you can still stay in here, but we're going to try to fix the problem. So I think in that case, you know, when adjunct instructors make mistakes like that, you have to kind of look, I guess, at the whole picture of what that instructor has done. So obviously even that instructor in this case made sure that there was no identifying, you know, tags on it, but still kind of miss the point of what you're trying to teach students about taking care of patients' needs. So, okay, any other questions? Yeah.
Somewhat similar situation. I keep quite a large class, and backstepping a little, when I started teaching at Gordon, I actually stumbled upon Greek-Korean fetuses in the class, and so they probably had been there for 1 year before I came on the scene. So I thought, like, what am I going to do with these, in the closet, should I throw the students? And so how I show them to the students is sort of a delicate process, similar to the five that you have to go through, but it's just one little small component of the class.
We actually have a collection. We have a collection of fetuses at APU, and I actually had a student project. She went through and put them in new jars and really took care of them because they hadn't been cared for in a while. I have not shown them to students yet, just because I haven't quite. Every semester, it's at the very end of the semester that we get to reproductive system. Some of those, we don't have any idea where those came from, similar to your situation. We have it certified that we had them before those laws went in place.
So they have there in the jars that actually are imprinted with the word ethicon?
So you, in that case, you have to be careful, too. You're not really sure what they're embedded or what the fluid is that they're in. And
they weren't from LMIC.
Yeah.
So what I do is I hide them. And I...
Yeah.
I tell students, listen.
Yeah.
Don't be talking loudly about this in
right.
the areas. And, you know,
right.
This is, you don't have to look at them. You don't have to look at them. I give them the opportunity to leave.
And I think that's real important. I think you have to give them a space to either look at it if they want to or a space to pull back. And it might also help to frame it in the way that you don't know that these cadavers were all from abortions either, because that's what everybody assumes. There are cases where women spontaneously, the babies are born prematurely, or you know there's a car accident and the mother dies. So there are a number of ways that those fetuses can be obtained. And they came about at a time when they weren't buried or they weren't. So it's, you know, so to frame it in a way, but I think it's really important to give students a way to say, I don't want to participate in this and just sit back or to look at it and some way to follow up outside of class
exactly.
if they have comments.
They're usually very thankful to see mm-hmm.
It's very powerful when they can see it, but yeah.
Thank you again, Kathleen.
Okay.